There stood another body, ready at hand, with which these royalists didn't reckon, far better equipped than the court to step in and take the place of an ineffective legislative assembly, and that was the strongly Jacobin commune of Paris, installed at the Hôtel de Ville. So far, France had been at peace. None of her neighbours had attacked her because she appeared to be weakening herself by her internal dissensions. It was Poland that suffered by the distraction of France, but there seemed no reason why they shouldn't insult and threaten her and prepare the way for a later partition at their convenience. At Pilnitz, in 1791, the King of Prussia and the Emperor of Austria met and issued a declaration that the restoration of order and monarchy in France was a matter of interest to all nations, and an army of émigrés, French nobles and gentlemen, an army largely of officers, was allowed to accumulate close to the frontier. It was France that declared war against Austria. The motives of those who supported this step were conflicting. Many Republicans wanted it because they wished to see the kindred people of Belgium liberated from the Austrian yoke. Many royalists wanted it because they saw in war a possibility of restoring the prestige of the crown. Marat opposed it bitterly in his paper L'Ami du Peuple, because he didn't want to see republican enthusiasm turned into war fever. His instinct warned him of Napoleon. On April the 20th, 1792, the king came down to the assembly and proposed war amidst great applause. The war began disastrously. Three French armies entered Belgium, two were badly beaten, and the third, under Lafayette, retreated. Then Prussia declared war in support of Austria, and the Allied forces under the Duke of Brunswick prepared to invade France. The Duke issued one of the most foolish proclamations in history. He was, he said, invading France to restore the royal authority. Any further indignity shown the king, he threatened to visit upon the assembly and Paris with military execution. This was surely enough to make the most royalist Frenchman a republican, at least for the duration of the war. The new phase of revolution, the Jacobin Revolution, was the direct outcome of this proclamation. It made the legislative assembly, in which orderly republicans, Girondins, and royalists prevailed. It made the government which had put down that republican meeting in the Champ de Mars and hunted Marat into the sewers impossible. The insurgents gathered at the Hôtel de Ville, and on the 10th of August the Commune launched an attack on the Palace of the Tuileries. The king behaved with a clumsy stupidity, and with that disregard for others which is the prerogative of kings. He had with him a Swiss guard of nearly 1,000 men, as well as national guards of uncertain loyalty. He held out vaguely until firing began, and then he went off to the adjacent assembly to place himself and his family under its protection, leaving his Swiss fighting. No doubt he hoped to antagonize assembly and commune, but the assembly had none of the fighting spirit of the Hôtel de Ville. The royal refugees were placed in a box reserved for journalists, out of which a small room opened, and there they remained for 16 hours, while the assembly debated their fate. Outside there were the sounds of a considerable battle. Every now and then a window would break. The unfortunate Swiss were fighting with their backs to the wall, because there was now nothing else for them to do. The assembly had no stomach to back the government's action of July in the Champ de Mars. The fierce vigor of the Commune dominated it. The king found no comfort whatever in the assembly. It scolded him and discussed his suspension. The Swiss fought until they received a message from the king to desist, and then, the crowd being savagely angry at the needless bloodshed and out of control, they were for the most part massacred. The long and tedious attempt to Merovingianize Louis, to make an honest crowned republican out of a dull and inadaptable absolute monarch, was now drawing to its tragic close. the Commune of Paris was practically in control of France. The Legislative Assembly, which had apparently undergone a change of heart, decreed that the king was suspended from his office, confined him in the temple, replaced him by an executive commission, and summoned a national convention to frame a new constitution. The tension of patriotic and republican France was now becoming intolerable. Such armies as she had were rolling back helplessly towards Paris. Longwy had fallen, the great fortress of Verdun followed, and nothing seemed likely to stop the march of the Allies upon the capital. The sense of royalist treachery rose to panic cruelty. At any rate, the royalists had to be silenced and stilled and scared out of sight. The Commune set itself to hunt out every royalist that could be found until the prisons of Paris were full. Marat saw the danger of a massacre. Before it was too late, he tried to secure the establishment of emergency tribunals to filter the innocent from the guilty in this miscellaneous collection of schemers, suspects, and harmless gentlefolk. He was disregarded, and early in September the inevitable massacre occurred. Suddenly, first at one prison and then at others, bands of insurgents took possession. A sort of rough court was constituted, and outside gathered a wild mob armed with sabres, pikes, and axes. One by one, the prisoners, men and women alike, were led out from their cells, questioned briefly, pardoned with the cry of Vive la Nation, or thrust out to the mob at the gates. There the crowd jostled and fought to get a slash or thrust at a victim. The condemned was stabbed, hacked, and beaten to death, their heads hewn off, stuck on pikes, and carried about the town, their torn bodies thrust aside. Among others, the Princesse de Lamballe, whom the king and queen had left behind in the Tuileries, perished. Her head was carried on a pike to the temple for the queen to see. In the queen's cell were two national guards. One would have had her look out and see this grisly sight. The other, in pity, wouldn't let her do so. Even as this red tragedy was going on in Paris, the French General Dumouriez, who had rushed an army from Flanders into the forests of the Argonne, was holding up the advance of the Allies beyond Verdun. On September the 20th occurred a battle, mainly an artillery encounter at Valmy. A not very resolute Prussian advance was checked. The French infantry stood firm. Their artillery was better than the Allied artillery. For 10 days after this repulse, the Duke of Brunswick hesitated, and then he began to fall back towards the Rhine. This battle at Valmy, it was little more than a cannonade, was one of the decisive battles in the world's history. The Revolution was saved. The National Convention met on September the 21st, 1792, and immediately proclaimed a republic. The trial and execution of the king followed with a sort of logical necessity upon these things. He died rather as a symbol than as a man. There was nothing else to be done with him. Poor man, he cumbered the earth. France couldn't let him go to hearten the emigrants, couldn't keep him harmless at home. His existence threatened her. Marat had urged this trial relentlessly, yet with that acid clearness of his, he wouldn't have the king charged with any offence committed before he signed the constitution, because before then he was a real monarch, super-legal, and so incapable of being illegal. Nor would Marat permit attacks upon the king's council. Throughout, Marat played a bitter and yet often a just part. He was a great man, a fine intelligence, in a skin of fire, wrung with that organic hate in the blood that's not a product of the mind, but of the body. Louis was beheaded in January 1793. He was guillotined, for since the previous August, the guillotine had been in use as the official instrument in French executions. Danton, in his leonine role, was very fine upon this occasion. "The kings of Europe would challenge us," he roared. "We throw them the head of a king." 11th. And now followed a strange phase in the history of the French people. There arose a great flame of enthusiasm for France and the Republic. There was to be an end to compromise at home and abroad. At home, royalists and every form of disloyalty were to be stamped out. Abroad, France was to be the protector and helper of all revolutionaries. All Europe, all the world, was to become republican. The youth of France poured into the republican armies, and new and wonderful song spread through the land, a song that still warms the blood, like wine, the Marseillaise.